Hello, everybody. Hi. Oh, my God. I didn't see you there. God, it's so good to see and hear from you again. Everyone, welcome to the show. I'm Liam Garrow, host, of course, of this now hopefully internationally beloved podcast, Tell Me Everything, the show where guests really have an opportunity to nerd out about their favorite people, places, and things in pop culture. And as is the case, we have procured absolutely nothing but the best for you. Our guest this week is the incredibly delightful, delectable, delicious Matt McConkey, actor, writer, podcaster. He's lent his talents to shows like, you know, the TV reboot of Heather's, Bajillion Dollar Properties. You've maybe even seen him in shows like Happy Endings. He also has a fabulous podcast alongside Dave Holmes called Homophilia, which you should be listening to, rating, subscribing, all those wonderful things. He's just a delightful, delightful man. I really also just like love, love, love this podcast. And also, for Christ's sakes, I'm bearing the GD lead. Everyone, Happy New Year. My God, 2024. Can you believe we made it another year? I barely can. Everyone, let's get right to it. There's no point in, you know, belaboring the wait any longer than it needs to. Here's the absolutely wonderful Matt McConkey. Matt, honey.
Liam, it's been so long.
It's been approximately 1 week in real time and 3 months in podcast time because you, very, very, very generously had me on your gorgeous, gorgeous podcast, Homophilia, I guess like what, a week or two ago now by this point. And I'm going to be honest, I felt an immediate connection with you. Even through our Zoom screens, I felt like there was something physical that happened to me. I can't explain it. You know,
I'm right there with you. We're on the same page, you know, and I do talk openly about how I often have to interview people on Homophilia that I frankly don't like. I don't care for.
Good and to know.
Let's just say this was not one of those instances.
Oh, I cannot wait for you off mic to tell me exactly who those names are.
I will.
And that's
we'll
going to be
notes.
Can I say, this is true, knock on wood. Every person that's appeared on the show has been nothing but a dream and a delight. And I'll tell you the real story off mic. The point is this, sometimes we have to build a public narrative so that we can protect the private one. You understand.
Exactly. Speaking of, I publicly need to apologize to you because on Homophilia, I repeatedly referred to you as Liam Garrow. And I know that it's Liam Garrow. Am I saying it wrong? Am I saying it right now?
Liam Garrow. It is Liam Garrow, but can I be honest? You're chatting to the right person about this because I don't care about how my name gets pronounced at all. I just care that people are saying it.
Well, I'm with you there. But it's a beautiful last name and it deserves to be said right. There are just some names that I have a little bit of a block on and I can't. We will always take me just an extra beat to say Garrow.
Well, and Garrow. It's the kind of thing too, where it's like, I don't know, how do I explain it? It's almost like, if you're listening to a record, like an actual vinyl record, and then it like, if you hit like an old like groove in the record, like the sound just stops. Like that's how my brain works with certain names where it's like, I am a perfectly literate and capable enough person. And yet when I make my way to the word, my brain says, you're going to stop right now. Because we know that you're going to embarrass yourself. And we would rather you exercise the due diligence in asking what this is instead of completely humiliating yourself. I mean, I almost just said humiliating. I mean, I'm so vulnerable on the mic, everybody.
Oh my God. I've really taken us off track, but I wish I even had the good sense to hesitate when I said Liam Garrow with such confidence.
But I also have a wonderful thing about you. You just like bulldozed through. You said, no, my confidence will carry me. And it did. Because honestly, in the moment, I was like, that is my name.
I was wrong and strong. And honestly, maybe, I mean, think about it. Liam Garrow.
But what were you going to say about your friend?
It's gone. Oh, I have a friend whose sister's name is, and I'm definitely going to get this wrong. It's not Andrea. It's also not Andrea. It's also not Aunt, I can't even, it's none of the pronunciations that one wants to go to. And I've just stopped saying it out loud because I can't.
It's to me, it's kind of like when you meet a Deborah and she insists on being called Deborah. And I'm like, we can't do this. I can't do this. Now, honey, how are you? So listen, this is a bit in the time machine. We are going to be releasing this in the new year. Actually, fun fact, you're going to be our first episode in the year 2024.
Oh, thrilling.
Thrilling. But now, so obviously I can't ask about how your holiday's been because it has yet to happen, but I will ask you this. Are you a resolutions person? Are you someone who wants to take stock of that time moving forward into the new year? Any sort of goals or ambitions moving into next year that will bring us closer to death?
You know, at the end of every year, I have a tradition with a group of like 10 girlfriends that is a coven of witches, frankly. Mm-hmm. And we get together with a dear friend who's an astrologer, you know, like you do. We all have one in our communities, right? Mm-hmm. And
when you say communities, you mean LA. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And we do, that is kind of a gathering that's all about, you know, feeling into what the last year was, what we want to let go. I call it the annual day of sobbing, you know, because we journal, we read to each other what was in the journal, you know, we each get a little mini reading and we kind of reflect back on what we've seen in each other. And we've been doing this for, I think, over 10 years now. And anyway, all that to say, by the time that is over, I feel I've had such a spiritual exorcism that I don't have anything left in terms of like a resolution. I feel like, oh, well, now I'm completely healed. And then, of course, it goes away very quickly. So, yeah, no, 72 I'm not hours really later. A resolutions person, you know, and I'm guessing you're not either.
I'm okay. And this is Matt. This is why we work. We established this on the pod. No, honestly, and I also want people to know this is yours and I second time speaking. Okay.
That's right.
This is our second conversation. But what I know, and I said this on your show, there is something, I feel like you and I are cut from a very similar cloth. I just have a feeling about this because you are right. I am also not a resolutions person. If anything, I think I treat my birthday more like a new year, because that's like your own personal new year, right? Mm-hmm. So like I'm a person who I don't really have like a concrete, like I really love what you're describing, this idea of like ritual when we're sitting with our friends, we're journaling, we're sharing, we're kind of talking about, you know, maybe things that we felt inhibited by, things that we want to sort of like free ourselves of. And I don't have a ritual built around that, but I do have the sense of like on a very quiet scale of just like, okay, what do I want to improve upon, or what are things that I want to like more? I think what you're describing sounds really kind of up my alley of like, what do I want to let go of a little bit? Like, what are bad habits I don't want to fall back on anymore? So no, not so much a resolutions person, but I would, I just want to endeavor on my journey of hotness is what I think I really am going to bulldoze forward to, in the new year.
Hard. I'm actually scared to imagine this escalating any further than it already has. But if you insist, the reason I said that I don't think you're a resolutions person is because I feel like based on what I know from our one conversation, even though it feels like it's hundreds, maybe in past life.
It feels like I've known you for 20 years. Go ahead.
Is that you are already kind of living what so many people are making resolutions for. You're getting up at 5 a.m. You're doing the HIIT workouts every morning. You're working your ass off, you know, professionally. You're making stuff when you want to make stuff. You're already doing all of the things.
And listen, when me becomes we, because I would say that is applicable to you and I, but also, you know, even before I had like, you know, any forward kind of like career momentum kind of stuff, I also wasn't a resolutions person. Cause I think I just was like, no, you need to do the thing. I think I always worried about like the resolution would sort of intellectualize something too much so that it wouldn't then just be something that would get put into practice. And I realized for a lot of people, the thinking about it is actually very useful for, step in getting that ball rolling. But for me, I just was like, no. I'm just going to keep this inside of myself and I'm just going to really actively try to like do it was sort of my idea. Now,
you're
listen,
walking the walk.
I'm walking the walk, and now it's time for you and I to talk the talk, because the reality is this. You have, first of all, again, listen, I'm just going to say it. I know that your husband isn't threatened by me, so I'm going to say whatever I want to say on this. And that is this. I already knew this was true, but then I saw what you brought to the show for your pop culture picks, and now I know. I love you, Matt McConkey. I just do.
Oh, God.
I just do.
I love you, Liam Garrow. See how I did that?
Boom. But you want to know something? Even if you had said Garrow, I'm like, whatever you want. Still, it doesn't matter. It does not matter to me. But now I'm curious to know, so you and I also share this in common where I think maybe there's something very true to maybe being like gay children creating rich inner worlds because we can't really be who we want to be on the outer world. You know what I mean? So can I assume you were a kid who really sort of like immersed yourself pretty deep into pop culture, books, movies, TV, music,
big
that whole
time.
Schmata? Yes.
Big time, big time. Like I don't even like to think about how I present now on the sort of like femme mask spectrum, whatever. I just don't want to sort of get trapped in the self-consciousness that creates in me. But I was an extremely, extremely femme child. And of course was like tortured for it, like so many of us are. And then was kind of forced into like putting on masculinity in a way when I was an adolescent by my dad.
Yeah.
And then you reach a point where you're like, you realize what bullshit that was.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, so do I revert? Do I try to go back to who I was when I was a little kid? I don't know. That doesn't quite feel natural either. So I try to just not think about it too much. Anyway, that's a very long way of saying I absolutely tick off every stereotype of a closeted gay child.
Yes.
Because exactly as you're saying, I didn't fit in. I was afraid of sports. I was afraid of boys. And most of my days were spent alone, either alone in my room playing with my, not to brag, but extensive collection of Barbies. Or I did have a small group of girlfriends who I could really get down with. And we would just, you know, lock ourselves up. And really, we would break story like you would in a writer's room. We would just be breaking story over our these epic Barbie soap operas that we were creating.
Yes. First of all, I was so a Barbie child. Let's get that straight. And I was also, it's interesting because I was also very terrified of men. And this is a very personal question, so brace yourself. But when you then were out and started to date men, did you also have to contend with that fear around men? Even in a romantic sense a little bit? Because I know that I did.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that I still am contending with that in a weird way.
Same.
I mean, I not, obviously like not when it comes to my husband. I mean, he's my everything, and he's like an angel that nobody would be scared of him. But you know, I think I tried to sort of swing the other way and just embrace the fact that like women were always my safe place. Women were always the friends that I could trust. And all of my close friends are women. But now that I've spent so many years sort of in that bubble, occasionally like I'll hang out with a straight guy and I'm like, you know what? You guys are kind of fun.
No kidding.
Okay. Yeah,
I've had a very similar come around, if you will, where I'm like, you know what, straight men, especially because the new breed of straight men, and this is fascinating to me about straight men now, they're dressing well, they're brushing their hair, they're using I feel statements, they're in therapy.
Yeah,
it is why I think a lot of them at first glance are gay. But then you ask them a little few more questions and then it's like, not at all.
No.
Because then, listen, do we think any of our straight friends like not walked, but ran to Barnes and Noble to purchase Barbara Streisand's memoir that got released today? We're in the time capsule and everyone like, come on, probably not. But you know what? If we told them that we did, they would be like, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoy the book instead of beating us up, which is
exactly
progress.
That's progress. Some of them might even want to hear about it.
Yeah.
A little bit, not too much.
Yeah, just how tempestuous was Mandy Patinkin on the set of Yentl. And I'm like, let me tell you, page 600, exactly, this is the thing. This is absolutely true. But now going back to you as then this like little adorable child and loving and sort of immersing yourself in these sort of external stories, I wonder if this might actually potentially be the perfect segue to your first, you know, sort of pop culture love. And that is, you have brought on, and this was such a classic for me, and I think it is for so many people, you have brought on The Wizard of Oz.
Imagine that, a gay man who loves The Wizard of Oz.
Well, except for to say, we've already by this point had many a gay man on the show, and this is the first, look, it's the first mention of Wizard of Oz, it's the first mention of Judy. We're breaking ground.
Believe me, I had to go back and double check through the episodes because I'm like, surely this has been addressed, but
no.
Thankfully, no.
So tell me everything. I want to know. So can I safely assume you were a child when you first encountered this movie?
Yeah. I don't remember a time that this movie wasn't in my life. I don't remember a time that I wasn't constantly rewatching it. And I even have, if I wouldn't fuck up our sound and tech here, I would lift up my laptop and take you over to a wall where I have a little shelf of figurines that are from 1989 that I collected when I was a kid and my mom sent to me. I didn't want them, frankly, but she sent them to me here in LA. And they're these like beautiful porcelain figurines of all the characters from the movie. And that is like the tip of the iceberg of the collection that still exists in my childhood home in Waverly, Ohio.
Really?
Massive collection of Wizard of Oz memorabilia. At one point, the public library invited me to come and put it on display. And I, you know, at like 9 years old, had a like curated a display of my Wizard of Oz collection in this little case in the public library.
You were already helping to facilitate this curatorial experience.
Yeah, yeah.
You were already an upper echelon gay, and you were not even in double digits, Matt.
No, it's shocking that none of the straight boys wanted to chat with me about that then.
Arguably their loss. And here's the thing. They may have wanted to, but they were so repressed that they didn't feel like they could, you know? And this is really, and when we sift through the layers, we're all just humans who want to love Judy Garland. And that's just true. And that's science.
That's just that. It feels good to be older and to just fully embrace my love for her. Cause then there's a period in my 20s where I sort of turned my back on this lifelong obsession, not even out of the fear that it was too gay. It just felt like too corny. And now I have embraced the fact that I am truly as basic as they come. And that includes simply loving Judy Garland and everything she does. I rewatch her Christmas special every year for Christmas. There's a Judy Garland impersonator here in LA who does a holiday show that I've gone to. My go-to Wizard of Oz story from my childhood is that when I was, I think, 9 years old, I was getting ready for school. I was listening to WNCI Columbus, Not Too Hard, Not Too Soft. And there was an announcement. It was St. Patrick's Day. And there was an announcement on the radio that in Columbus, Ohio, which is over an hour away from my tiny village that I live in, for St. Patrick's Day, in a pub, two of the original Munchkins from The Wizard of Oz are appearing. Now, this is where it gets a little problematic. They are dressed as leprechauns for St. Patrick's Day, but they're there,
you know,
and they're taking pictures and they're signing stuff. And I ran downstairs and told my mom, and she was like, okay, go grab a couple of your books for them to sign. I'm going to call the school. I'm going to cancel my meetings. Tell your sister that she can come too, and she can also skip school. And we jumped in the car because we were like, time was of the essence. We drove as fast as we could. At one point, my mom pulls over and calls from a payphone and calls the bar. And she's like, are the Munchkins still there? And they're like, they're here, but you better hurry. We drive as fast as we can. We like speed into the parking lot of this bar. We run inside. And like, I swear to God, the bartender's literally like, It's empty. He's wiping down the bar. He's like, sorry, folks, you missed the munchkins. We're like, no. My mom goes, where are they? Where did they go? And he goes, I think they are flying home. They have to go to like a convention or something. She's like, kids, get in the car. We drive to the Columbus airport. We park. We go to the terminal and we just sit in the big sort of atrium and we're literally just waiting for a little person. And we see one and I'm like, mom, that's got to be her. That's got to be her. And I'm like, go ask her. And she's like, no, this is for you. Go ahead. So I have to march up my gay ass little with my little man. Wizard of Oz books and go, excuse me, were you in the Wizard of Oz? And thank God the answer was yes, because imagine
that could have gone south.
Her name was Margaret Pellegrini, and she was one of the most active munchkins until she actually died within the last decade. And she was such a pro. She was immediately like, oh yeah, I see your books there. I'm on the back cover of that one. I'm on page 286 and 187 of that one. Here's give me your pen. I'll sign. You know, she fired off a couple of her sort of go-to anecdotes, said that, of course, Judy Garland was very nice. And, that was it.
Yes.
And she had to go catch her plane. And I soared on that experience. I'm still soaring, frankly.
Yes. And wait, what's your mom's name?
Evelyn.
Because that is some good goddamn parenting. Evelyn? Well done. That was exquisite mothering. That really was very, very, very good parenting.
Yeah. Thank you for indulging me. I mean, it's one of my favorite memories. It tells you everything you need to know about the kind of mom she was. And yeah, you know.
But the real question too, well, I'm curious to know, do you like what was it about The Wizard of Oz? Because I mean, it's interesting what you said earlier when you said, you know, you can't envision a time where you didn't remember The Wizard of Oz. I mean, the same is true for me. And, you know, in spite now of the fact that that movie is like, what, 90 or like approaching 100 some odd years old, I think little kids now, still, it's almost like cellularly just like a part of their identity. It's like, you know, Wizard of Oz, you know, the ruby slippers, you know, you know it. But for you, can you, you know, walk me and our audience through why you think it was, you know, as impactful as it was and why it sort of continued in being this, you know, sort of real, sounds like it honestly still has like a real firm place in the corner of your heart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I'm glad to hear you say that you think it still has this effect on kids today, because I feel like my friends who are having children, I'm a little alarmed by the lack of Wizard of Oz exposure that's happening, you know, when I'm like, oh, so sorry, they watched the Minions again, but still haven't. Okay. Quietly judging your parenting.
My glasses are off. My fingers are firmly pressed to my temples. That was terrible news you just shared.
Yeah, I don't think they are getting the education that they need to get. But I'm also like, if that's because parents know that it would not hold the same magic for kids as it does for us, that's also horrifying. So I'm like, okay, well, the last thing I want is for these kids to see the movie and then be like, oh, I didn't really like it. I wouldn't be able to live in that world. Anyway.
I take my own life.
Absolutely. We would do a mass suicide as a community.
Yeah. I mean, joint death pact. Let's get your husband in on it. And he's like, I'm not really attached to this. So I'm like, it's not really about you right now. Like we have a point to prove. Yeah.
He'll get
it. But it meant so much to you because what?
Because you know, I mean, like I said, I grew up in a literal village in Waverly, Ohio, you know, super rural, could not have felt more out of place. I also was adopted and grew up knowing that I was adopted. And so there's also the dreaming of this other life and other world happening that so many closeted kids that grow up in the Midwest have anyway. But I think I just had another layer of that happening because I was also like, well, what's happening with my, you know, biological family? And and it was just like, I was not meant for this place, and there is another place far away. My family, I mean, my mom, obviously a saint and love her more than anything, but we were so, so, so deeply dysfunctional. And, you know, what Dorothy finds when she, I mean, all of the gay metaphors are just so on the nose, but when she, everything that she finds when she goes to Oz is really about chosen family. And I think even then I knew that that was going to be my experience. I was going to go to Oz. I was going to find my chosen family, but I probably wasn't going to go back. You know, place like home thing, I have a complicated relationship with that message.
Well, because I think for people like you and I who maybe grew up in whatever form of dysfunctional, you know, verbiage you want to sort of ascribe to whatever, you know, our living situations were. You know, how about this? I moved away from my home to live on my own when I was 19, and I moved like several thousand miles away and like to a city that I had, you know, had never been to before, really. I didn't know anyone, but I was like, I knew that's where I was supposed to be anyway. Long story short, I encounter this woman years later, my friend Amanda, who was sharing her own story of having been in therapy. And she was asked the question, have you ever been homesick? And my friend Amanda was like, no. Hmm. And then the therapist said, you know, that's actually a very uncommon response. And my friend goes, oh, really? She's like, yeah. I mean, she goes, think about all the university students on campus where there are counselors set aside for them quite literally just to help them process the feelings of being away from home. Usually people who don't feel homesick means that they're not missing the place that they're coming from because there was something that they felt like they were trying to escape. And so this whole idea of there's no place like home, I think that really only starts to become true for adults who feel like they really cultivate their own separate sense of home beyond the place that they grew up.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And I left home at 18 and went to New York, and it could not have been, you know, a more extreme change of lifestyle, but I didn't experience it that way. I experienced it like, oh, I was in the wrong place, and now I've arrived in a city that this simply makes sense to me. Like the pace and the energy and the crowds and everything about this city, just this is where I was supposed to be. And there was a mistake, and now we've rectified it, you know?
And moving, you know, beyond the Wizard of Oz as a whole, I mean, is it safe to assume also that like some of the adult love also extends to just like, and again, you're right, it is on the nose, but for Christ's sakes, I mean, it holds true for a reason. Like, can I assume it also was like the Judy Garland of it all? Like this.
Oh, of course.
Kind of very broken, but like otherworldly talented kind of person.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's been so much said and written about like the pain and vulnerability that's in every single Judy Garland performance. And that just gets truer and deeper the older she gets. But yeah, it was present even then. She was, I think, 16 when she made The Wizard of Oz. And even then, and obviously Over the Rainbow is like the ultimate I want song. Even then, I don't know. I felt something in her that I'd never felt in another person on screen. And, you know, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that she felt like an outsider herself in the world that she was in. And that came through in her performance. And she's just such a fucking great actor, too. You know?
Well, I'm glad you said that actually, because, you know, so much, particularly when you think of sort of what now is upheld as being the golden age of Hollywood, you know, in the 40s and the 50s. And, you know, there was a huge shift in the acting style taking place in the 50s, because, of course, all of a sudden we had more of an introduction of the method, the actor studio. You saw actors like James Dean, Marlon Brando, Paul Newman, so on and so forth. But I actually really feel like Judy Garland was really the
first actor, especially coming from the era that she did, that was really parlaying a lot of that, without me maybe even really meaning to, but was parlaying a lot of those lessons and sort of ideologies about acting and performance into her work. Because, you know, so oftentimes is the case, even when you watch stuff now, that again, for movies that are like now at this point, almost 100 years old,
yeah,
there is, you know, of course there's something that feels like it lives in that time and space, and understandably so, but there is something still that feels so, I mean, especially you look at a performance like in A Star Is Born, where you're like, there's something so vital and real and contemporary feeling, because she's just using her own feelings. It's not about the affect of what someone's supposed to look and sound and move like in this old, you know, 1940s, 50s Hollywood picture. It's just about her being like this pulsing nerve on a camera.
This is so brilliant and insightful, and I've never even thought of it that way. So thank you for putting words to something that I never quite knew how to articulate about why I love her. But that's so, so true. It's like so many of her peers were people, especially in like the early days, who were like just like technical actors, you know, like they just knew how to hit their mark and they knew how to make the right face. And she knew how to do all that stuff too, but it was like she didn't have any choice but to bring all of herself to everything she did, and all of that pain and vulnerability. And like, obviously it's what, you know, took her down in the end, but yeah, it's what makes especially A Star Is Born so incredible.
Well, and I'll never forget, and I'll say this and then we'll move on to your next thing, but I believe it was Frank Sinatra who said about Judy Garland, and of course they performed together, I believe they were sort of, you know, old friends, but said that about Judy Garland, every time she sang, there was a little part of her that died inside.
Yeah.
Like, because she just gave that much and just like knew, like, just, oh my God. And also, like, even now, all these decades later, peerless.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, there's never been anyone like her.
No, it's so true.
Incredible. Incredible. Now, your next pop culture pull, I must say, this is one that I have long been meaning to get to, and I will really cop to the fact that I'm very ignorant about this next thing, so I would love to be educated on it by you, because it is the extremely beloved, extremely like critically venerated show, The Leftovers. And this was a show I know starring Justin Theroux, Carrie Coon, and something that I know famously from the show, because this of course had its viral moment, was when Justin Theroux was in a head-to-toe sweatsuit and seemed to really just be freeballing the hell out of it.
Right. For no good reason. Just jogging on camera without underwear on.
I mean, there was a good reason. Yeah.
I can't say that I knew that at the time. He was also married to Jennifer Aniston at the time. She's really my, if I had to choose one pop culture moment, she's not even a moment. She's my religion. So that was my first way in, was simply like, oh, Jen's husband is doing this show. I love Damon Lindelof. I liked Lost a lot. And I mean, God, the show is such a downer. It is the grimmest, bleakest thing that has ever been on TV. And so it turned a lot of people off for that. But that's often makes me lean in. And, you know, the premise, it's based on a book by Tom Parada, but the premise is that, like, it's
2% of the... Tom Parada, who I believe he did Little Children, right?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yeah.
And he did... the premise is that 2% of the population suddenly disappears in one moment, and there's no explanation. No one knows where they went. No one knows why they went. There didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason as to who the 2% were. And the story, you know, is called The Leftovers, because it's about everybody who's left behind, and it takes place a couple years after the fact.
It's time again for the world to mourn the departed.
Disappearance of 2% of the world's population.
None of them are coming back.
Yeah, probably not.
So many of our loved ones were lost 3 years ago. We still wonder where they went and why.
Some bad shit's coming and there's no getting around it. Grace period's over. Nor everybody
else. So, you know, it's about grief, which now feels like that's the thing that everybody says about everything. They say everything is about grief, trauma, generational trauma. Like, these are the themes that we keep exploring.
To quote Jamie Lee Curtis, trauma.
Have you seen the super cut where of just her saying trauma? Yeah. Oh,
but,
God.
But also, here's what's wild. She's saying the word trauma, but she's saying it in different ways each time. And it's from her promotional push when she was doing, what was it, like Halloween Ends or one of those, mm-hmm. like one of them sort of more recent Halloween incarnations. And it's incredible to me. I'm like, Diva, I know how a press junket works. You did all of those from that same morning and you said trauma different every single time.
It's amazing.
And that's why she has an Oscar.
That's right. She says it different every time, but also wrong every time. It's me saying Liam Garreau over and over and over again with a slight variation, but God, that should have been one of my pop culture moments. But like The Leftovers also like is about all of these people searching for me, you know, in the wake of an event like that, people, you know, start joining cults and they start becoming like nihilists and blowing up their own lives. And it's just everyone is like searching for meaning in all of these different ways that intersect with like religion and paranormal beliefs and all this stuff that I am so interested in. Anything having to do with the afterlife, kooky paranormal beliefs, UFOs, ghosts, what have you. I don't believe in any of it, but I yearn to believe in something. I don't have any religious beliefs, but I yearn to believe in that. And so mm-hmm. that, I think, is why The Leftovers grabbed me the way it did, is like, that's really what it's about, is like the constant striving for answers when you know that there aren't any.
Right.
And that... just kind of the question of like, is that striving and yearning itself meaningful enough? You know, maybe that's all that we're meant to do. And the theme song is, I can't remember the singer's name. It's this great like country song, Let the Mystery Be. Iris Dement, maybe, I don't remember. And yeah, it just got me. It's one of those things that I rewatch over and over again. You know, and I don't know, I hope is maybe the bleakest thing that anybody ever brings to your show.
Well, I mean, until someone just hopefully just is like, I want to talk about my dead cat. And I'm like, well, that's kind of off topic. But I mean, if you really feel compelled, God bless. But no, I mean, I think you mentioned this idea of not, you know, being religious, neither am I, but still like, you know, this idea of kind of this like search and quest for yearning and answers for this sort of thing that we don't know about, like it's, but it is the intrinsic thing, of course, that we all have in common, right? We are all born, we all die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the one thing though that I think is true of it with everyone is whether you are religious, whether you are someone who gathers with 10 women at New Year's to, you know, outpour, you know, your innermost, you know, stories and secrets,
traumas
and desires and trauma and traumas. The thing about Jamie Lee Curtis is she really speaks from the bottom of her jaw. Trauma.
Oh, you're right.
Trauma.
Yeah.
She really, it's down here all the time. It's down here all the
God,
time.
You're so right.
But she, but I think whether you are religious, whether you're someone who's going to a psychic, whether you're doing any sort of like existential reading, what is true is that we all just need our little stories.
Yeah.
Because it's helping to make this intrinsically unknowable thing seem more palatable. Because if we feel like we can have even the slightest grasp on it, I think it won't be so overwhelmingly devastating. You know what I mean? Or just so overwhelmingly confusing.
Yeah. And have you found something that fills that void for you?
No. And if anything, I mean, listen, I have spent money on psychics and I'm very much a believer that, you know, there are psychics out there who are real. Like this isn't so, you know, but I'm just saying like, I think the, you know, I think a very like common sort of deeper question that someone asks themselves, or maybe if someone else is, you know, well, what happens when we die? And the thing I've realized for myself is I have no idea, and at this present moment I am perfectly fine with that.
Mm.
because I don't really think it's funny. I brought her up on your show. You know, Linda Ronstadt, of course, being one of my, if not my favorite woman alive, second to my mother. I mean, you know, my favorite woman alive. And, you know, of course, in her diagnosis with progressive nuclear palsy, as her health is deteriorating, you know, she's asked about, you know, so what are you thinking then about the sort of next phase of your life, this next act of your life? And she said, well, you know, I'm not afraid of dying, but I am afraid of suffering. I just hope that when it happens, I'm not in pain. And I think that's sort of my thing is like, not if, but when it happens, I just hope that it is like relatively easy. You know, if that, yeah. God willing, if I could just go in my sleep.
That's the way. That is the way.
Well, how about for you? What about, do you have any sort of, is there something that's helping to sort of fill that void for you?
You know, I've been a seeker for a long time. I've had stages where I was, you know, Marianne Williamson used to speak in LA every Monday night and I used to go, and it was like sort of New Age church. And, mm-hmm. And then a friend introduced me to Gabby Bernstein, and she's sort of like a self-styled, like millennial Marianne Williamson. And, you know, read some of her books, did some of her meditation challenges, all that stuff. Done like a lot of like meditating, breath work, all of the things I'm trying, you know.
Girl, I've gone to a sound bath. Believe me, I've spent an hour in a sound bath. I get it.
Yeah. And I'm so available for all those things all the time. I've done the artist's way, the morning pages, the artist dates, all of those things. And I would say all of them have been very, very helpful.
Good. Yes. I mean, here's the thing. I've also found it to be of service. I don't know that it's helped me to, I can't say that it's given me necessarily like a clarity about like what's to come in a way. But maybe if anything, what this sort of study has given me is that like, we don't know and that's okay. Or at least it's okay for me.
Yeah, and it's mostly okay for me as well. I mean, I just to bring us down a little lower than I've already taken us in terms of depressing topics.
Okay, everyone, we're in the basement. Someone pull out the bulldozer. We're going to absolutely blow up the cement floor and we're going to keep digging. Okay, keep going.
I had a close friend die in May, and his name was Michael Hannes. He went by Mike Nice. I called him Eagle, and we called each other Eagle. And Eagle was the funniest person I definitely ever met, ever saw perform, ever possibly ever to live. And everyone who knew him would agree, you know, he was kind of a frustrated comedian who never found his like creative outlet, but like to know him was to live inside his comedy. And when he died, I was obviously devastated, but I was really in a place where I was like, he's coming to visit me. Like I can feel him and we're going to be in touch. Eagle and I are going to be in touch. I have his name his handwriting tattooed on my forearm. And I remember going to like an acupuncture session right after he died and talking to the acupuncturist about it. And then he puts on, and if you're in LA, go to see Russell at Poke Acupuncture. He is amazing. And every acupuncture session is like the best therapy session you've ever had, because you also talk a lot before he does the treatment. We talked about Mike. He does a treatment on me, and then he puts on like a light show on the ceiling, and you're just lying there staring at it and seeing all of the shapes and things and whatever, and I'm just sobbing, and I'm like, he's coming. This is the moment. Like you know, they say acupuncture is the thing that like kind of, because the needle represents like piercing the veil between you and the spiritual world.
I hadn't heard that phrase a lot better than that.
But I was like, this is the moment. I mean, I'm ready, you know, and I can't say that he has. And anyway, this is a very long, sad spiel, that I'm still remaining open to it, to being haunted by my dear friend, because
yes,
because I know he would do it in the most hilarious way ever. He will be, if he ever does visit me, the funniest ghost of all time.
Well, the real question then has to be, how, and if in a perfect world, when and where is he haunting you?
God, it's a good question. You know, if I ever go back to Coachella, and I can't imagine at this stage, now that I'm, you know, well into my late 20s, I don't.
Yes, that's right.
I think that my Coachella days are behind me, but we had a couple Coachella adventures together that were so ridiculous and laughed to the point of like physical illness. And if I ever make it back there, I think that would be the perfect spot.
Who was the most dynamic performer you two saw together at Coachella?
Robin.
What year?
God, I don't know. I mean, it had to have been around 2010.
Okay, so we're talking Body Talk era? Okay, okay.
Yeah, or maybe right before that. It might have even been right before. But it was a Coachella where I was going to go off on another tangent that absolutely no one cares about. I've taken us into the strangest territories, Liam. I'm sorry.
Diva, we're all here for you. Go for it. Now is your time to shine.
There was a Coachella where I was supposed to meet him. I was at some Airbnb separate from him on the first night, and I couldn't get a ride to the festival. And I don't remember. I guess I was in Palm Desert. The Airbnb was not close, and there were no Ubers. There were no cabs. I couldn't find a way to get there. And I was like, the shows are starting, and like Mike is there, and things are happening. And finally, I just walked out of the Airbnb and started running. And I ran through the desert. And there were no streetlights. You know, I was on a road for most of it, but it was pitch black and terrifying.
Oh my God.
And a very long run. But I was like, I have to get there. And if I don't do this, I'll never get there. And you know, reached many points where I was like, well, I'm going to die out here and I'm not going to make it. I finally there. I finally get in. Then I can't get him on the phone. I don't know where he is. I just start walking toward Robin, and I see this, he was like 6'5", blonde hair. And I just like jump up and jump onto his back and scared the actual shit out of him. But it was such a joyful reunion once he realized that I wasn't trying to murder him.
Which is always usually how it goes with you with people. They're like, wait, what's happening? Oh, wait, it's just Matt. Someone's not trying to murder me.
Yeah.
I think you just, you know what it is? You just physically, you come in a little hot.
Yeah.
Come in a little hot.
That's right. Your and then couple that with like me running, I don't know, 5 miles through the dark of the desert, and I'm on a real adrenaline high.
I imagine sweating.
Oh, yeah. And I was just like, I'm here. Let's watch Robin. Where are the drugs? Let's go.
Absolutely. Well, and of course, the next question I was going to have was like, and what were we on? I mean, now here's the thing. I will say, I'll say this, and then we'll move on to your last gorgeous pull. I don't know whether I'm sure you've heard this before, but like one thing that I have always kind of like thought was actually quite nice about this idea of like people like passing on, and this idea of like, do they visit us? Is there energy? Like, I was even told, like, hey, when you just kind of like, when they come up in conversation or when you think of them, like, that's them going like, boop. Like, that's them. Mm-hmm. That's them giving you the nudge of like, I'm in front. Like, I'm here. Like, yeah. You think that you just thought of me, but I implanted the thought in your brain. Like, so I'm like, oh, you know what? That's kind of a nice thought. So if anyone's ever just like, I don't know, thinking about someone that you've loved and have lost, and if you just sort of, if they just appear in your brain, it's because they are making themselves known. And I don't know. I indulge in my fair share of woo-woo, but I enjoy that as an ideology.
I enjoy that
as a
quite
thought.
A bit. I guess, thank you, Eagle, for dropping by.
Yeah, that's right. And then here, and this would be the perfect moment, especially considering that we're on the West Coast, is if like both in front of our respective homes, if we just saw an eagle fly. Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Oh, God, I know. I live in Eagle Rock, and I do see, like, some big birds flying. And is it a crow? Is it a hawk? Is it an eagle? I never quite know. But, I mean, I always think it's an eagle.
I like to think it's an eagle, too. Now, your last pop culture pick, I will say, the breadth that also that we're covering, we have an old-timey Hollywood classic. We have a contemporary show that is really meditating on grief, loss, death, the afterlife. And then you bring us your Thward gorgeous pop culture pool, girl, okay? And that is the new, very new Netflix docuseries Beckham.
I don't think I've ever talked about it just because I can't. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. It took a toll on me that I never even knew myself.
Ferguson admitted he had kicked the boot, accidentally striking Beckham.
And then I've gone like that. And then I've gone like that.
You went at him.
Yeah.
It's really entertaining when the circus comes to town, right? Unless you're in it.
It's all right, Buster. They can't get in the car.
We were drowned.
I know. It couldn't be a stranger pull.
So hang on. First of all, I guess the first and natural question is, like, I mean, you mentioned being frightened of sports as a young gay child, which, first of all, to anyone listening at home, believe me when I say that fear lingers with us into adulthood. Like, and I know you've experienced this, as is every single gay man alive. You know, there's like a moment if you should happen to be like walking past a park and there just happens to be like a ball that rolls in your direction because it got kicked too far out, you know? And then you have just this group of like men innocuously saying like, hey, yeah, just throw it back. You're like,
oh fuck.
I have the weight of our people on my shoulders and I have to throw that ball back because it's like, you can't be too gay when you throw it. You have to throw it far. You need to throw it in the right direction. And can I say, more oftentimes than not, I'll pretend I don't hear them and I'll just walk past the ball because I can't
do
this.
What else can you do?
Well, I guess throw it back. But then, and what, risk my life? Risk my life?
Absolutely not. I had that last night and I was coming from, the reason I chose Beckham and the reason I think that I became obsessed with this show is that I for whatever reason, am having some kind of reckoning around my like relationship with sports. And I'm trying to kind of heal that trauma in a weird way. A lot of trauma. That is manifesting, yeah. that trauma, a lot of that's manifesting through playing pickleball, just because it is an approachable sport. It's, you know, it's a lot more welcoming.
It's also very in right now. It's very in right now, pickleball. Yeah.
It's very in right now. I'm in a gay pickleball league. And the nice thing about playing there, I will say the gay boys are very good and they are beasts. And
I believe it.
In a weird way, re-traumatizing myself every time I play badly. But anyway, the reason I brought it up is last night as I was leaving practice, there was a kids' soccer game happening and a ball rolled off the field right in front of me. And I was like, well, here we go. What am I going to do? And I waited for somebody to notice, ask for it back. Yeah. Nobody did, so I kept on walking.
Hell yeah. And you know what? And that's gay rights, as they say.
Rights,
and
baby.
That is gay rights. So now, why are you loving this docuseries so much? I mean, I know you're sort of saying like, oh, it's healing this sort of inner part of you, this idea of sports. But like, because I think you and I probably remember like when Beckham first hit and sort of like the cultural zeitgeist, it was just like, he was like this young, incredibly attractive, you know, virtuoso, you know, soccer player. I obviously knew that. I can't say that I was ever like especially like a big fan of his because sports was just so outside of my frame of reference. But why is this docuseries speaking to you so much?
I think it just has to do with this larger newfound interest in sports that I rejected my entire life, even though it was like my parents were begging for it. And I don't know.
Now 30 years later, you say, great news, great news. I'm doing it.
My mom loves Ohio State football. I've started watching Ohio State football. I took her to a game. Now I still don't fully understand the rules, but I have, I find it thrilling in a way I never did before. I was in band, so I went to every single football game every week of my entire high school, never even watched, felt nothing. But something has changed where I can actually like watch someone make a touchdown and go on the and get sucked into the drama of it and go on the emotional roller coaster and enjoy it. And yeah, I didn't pay any attention to David Beckham then. I knew nothing about him. Just kind of stumbled under.
I mean, I knew him because he dated Posh Spice. That's
exactly
what I knew him.
Yeah. And I went into this thinking this is called Beckham, and I thought, oh, this is about both of them. But it's a little bit of a bait and switch because yes, she's in it a lot, but it's about him.
Mm-hmm.
But the first of all, it's made by Fisher Stevens. He directed the Carrie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds documentary.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I almost chose
so
that.
So good.
Because I love her so much. He's just such a great filmmaker. And the story that gets told about David's career, he is so incredibly winning. Both of them are. Like they managed to feel like such real people, even though they're living a life beyond my imagination. And something has changed where now I'm able to watch all of this old footage of him in his games and really like marvel at his talent and like feel my sister-in-law was watching with me and she was laughing because I would cheer when he scored a goal. And we're watching like 20-year-old footage in a docuseries of a game that again, I barely understand how soccer works. But I started going to Angel City, was the LA women's soccer league that Natalie Portman founded. And those games, I mean, that is, to be there is to commune with, you know, the people of LA, but especially the upper echelon lesbians of LA. And that's
which
the
are really
community
the people
I
you
really
want to
get
in
get
with.
Exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
And we've been having so much fun at these games. Again, don't understand all the rules, don't always understand what's happening. But when I see someone do a literal backflip in the air to score a goal when the net
to
is behind her.
To kick a ball into a net.
Yeah, I'm like, this is, it doesn't get any better than this. It just
doesn't. First of all, not Matt McConkey absolutely entering his mask era, and we're so here for it. This is very exciting. But I also think, first of all, David Beckham, I will always was fascinated by because, and I have this every single time I hear him speak, his speaking voice is so incongruous to how he looks.
Because
you always think he's going to have like this really sort of like maybe like deep sort of like rugged voice. And he sort of talks like this. He's sort of like, hey, Victoria, come over here. Like, he's just so like, I'm like, I can't believe that we're dealing with a virtuoso soccer player who's also like a counter tenor. Like, incredible.
Yeah,
like, absolutely incredible. And also that I think part of why they seem so approachable is because I kind of have gathered, and I even, okay, do you remember in like 2007, 2008, Victoria Beckham had like a very short-lived reality TV show, I think on NBC?
No.
It may have even only been a TV special. Its gestation in the zeitgeist did not go a very long time, but it did exist. And I think there are clips of it, of course, that still sort of now will live in perpetuity online. And I remember having this thought even then. I was like, oh, they're both quite funny.
Yes.
And kind of like sort of seeming like kind of just like very chill, like very quintessentially like, for lack of a better term, English, just sort of here for a good time. Everything's cool. Like no big deal. Kind of plays down. Although I did see that clip that made me laugh really, really hard when Victoria Beckham was chatting about trying to paint her life as like a bit of maybe it being a little harder than it actually was. And when she would talk about the car that she was driven to school by her dad, tell the story. Cause that really made me laugh.
David keeps popping in. She's doing an interview and he keeps interrupting and she's trying to talk about how she and David both came up really working class. And, and David's like, tell him what car your dad had. And she's like, I mean, I can't even do her accent, but she sort of hems and haws and tries to explain. And he goes, nope, just one word. What car? And she goes, well, it depends on the time.
It wasn't every day.
Basically, she's like, okay, but he had a Rolls Royce. She took
and
me to school
like,
at a Rolls Royce. He's like, there you go.
Boom. There it is.
Yeah,
and there it is.
They just have such a cute relationship. I was having the weirdest reaction watching them, especially now in their 40s. They're like, you know, they're line dancing together to Islands in the Stream, and their kids are grown up now, and their kids seem like shockingly well adjusted and
adjusted?
Nice.
Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
And I don't know. I was like, wait, do I want children? Like I don't, but
don't.
I would
you
like
don't.
To, I would like to do it the way they, and I understand I would need hundreds
so
of
money.
Millions of dollars.
So much money.
To
and
have
nannies.
Their home.
And yeah.
But I'm open to that. I'm open to making hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, okay. Well, for anyone listening at home, if you are kind of on the fence about just giving Matt McConkey hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, you've been given the green light. It's totally okay. And you will use this, I assume, to purchase slash adopt a child of your choosing, and then you can raise them to the lifestyle that you think you should also be accustomed.
Yeah, I'm gonna buy an amazing like farmhouse in the English countryside as close to the Beckhams as I can get. Mm-hmm. He also has a bee colony and makes his own honey. He's cool.
And
I don't know what else to say. He's simply cool.
And that's the show. He has his own bee colony.
Yeah. He's making his own honey. He wants to call it, I think just, he wants to call it something dumb, like golden honey. And Victoria wants him to call it DB sticky
Beckham's
stuff.
Bees. Ew,
Beckham's
no.
bees is the
Beckham's
obvious
bees.
Answer. Yeah. Come
that
on,
should be
guys.
It, obviously. Guys, the alliteration, it's right in
it's right
front of
there.
You. And this is why, you know what? And see, do you want to know why you and I don't have hundreds of millions of dollars? Is because like idiots, we're just saying all of our good ideas on a podcast for people to
God
steal.
Damn it. You're
everyone,
right.
You know what? A note to my producer, Mimi, I'm going to remind her, we're going to file a copyright claim.
Mm-hmm.
No one can steal this. Mm-hmm. Beckham's bees, that's us. And if David Beckham, if you're listening, I know you're listening. Not if, but when you want to get serious about your business, you come see us because we're going to buy beckhamsbees.com, .ca, .co.uk, .ca. And that's just that, Mimi, bad news, Mimi Collins in the chat. I've already stolen it.
Oh,
she's already stolen it.
No.
Well, first of all, to my producer, and you know what? And if there's one thing we love about Mimi, well, it's two things. She's really quick on the draw, and God damn it, she's honest. She could have really strung us along for a really long time there, but she didn't, and that means the world. So Mimi,
I really respect that. She deserves whatever's coming to her.
Whatever hundreds of millions of dollars Mimi's going to make, I really think she deserves it, even though, you know, she did steal our idea. But now, Matt, you have been so glorious to talk to. So, you know, this is the problem that I have with you is because when you're like on my little screen, I just want to talk to you for like 300 more hours. But I feel like, so here's the thing. I've shared with you, I'm going to be in LA in March. I just think, listen, we're going to hang out in person. I just
Absolutely.
Think there should be like so many drinks is what I've decided.
Absolutely. Let's go.
I mean,
I'm ready.
I'm absolutely, that needs to happen. Before you leave us, we must let people know you, of course, alongside the glorious Dave Holmes, who was, now was he jealous? Admit it, like really be honest.
He's
he really
actually stopped speaking to me since I got to do that episode with you one-on-one and he didn't get to. It's actually destroyed our friendship.
Aww.
That's how jealous he was. So yeah.
That's beautiful to hear. I really like that. I love to think that there's a universe that exists where I hold enough societal clout or cachet to destroy two men's relationships. And
that's the world I'm living in. I don't know what you're talking about. That's
real. Listen, Homophilia, available wherever people get their podcast, you and the glorious Dave Holmes. And now also let people know what other things do you want people to know about? What do you want people to support? Where can people find you? Give us the whole spiel.
Yeah, I also host a podcast called And Just Like Matt that is about And Just Like That and Sex and the City and talk to fellow fanatics. And, you know, it's sort of a recap show, but it's more of like a religious movement. And I believe me, I was going to choose Sex and the City or And Just Like That to talk about with you, but I know that Paul F. Tompkins beat me to it.
Sorry.
You know, you can also get that wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm on Instagram at the Matt Grassy.
Well, because, you know, here's the thing. Professionally, he's still McConkey, but to the rest of the world, for his real friends and for the people who care, his, you know, your glorious husband's last name, Beautiful.
Matt Grassi. Yeah. I mean, that's only, you know, in my close personal inner circle, dear friends like you, Liam, Garrow, and the Beckhams, you know, they can all call me by my new Christian name.
You mean the Beckhams of Beckham's Bees?
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
So glad to hear they ended on their feet with that honey business. God bless. You have been so delicious to talk to. Thank you for doing this. This went by way too quickly.
You're such a dream. Thank you for letting me take us on the strangest side roads and tangents and all of it.
I was here for it.
You've created a safe space, and I appreciate you for it.
Oh, my pleasure. Listen, see you in LA.
See you in LA.
Bye. Well, my major thanks to Matt. That was really wonderful. Matt McConkie, everyone be sure to follow him on social media. Make sure you're listening to Homophilia. Make sure you're listening to And Just Like Matt. I don't know what else to say. You know, it's so funny. It just, there are people who, when you meet them, even in like these very small contained little situations, you're like, you're delightful. Let's talk more. This is wonderful. Listen, if you are enjoying the show, and Christ almighty, I hope you are, I would love it if you could rate, review, and subscribe, share the show around, give it a 5-star rating, leave a little review, you know, do the nice due diligence things that a podcast listener can do if they're, you know, enjoying and helping to support a show. And as always, I want to leave our audience with my own little favorite pop culture thing happening at the minute. I alluded to it in the episode, and I realize now we're a few months behind, but I have just started Barbra Streisand's memoir, My Name is Barbra. I am on chapter 2. This is totally true. This is a 900-page book, and I'm already wishing it were 900 more pages. I'm listening to the audiobook, and she has the most delightful, buttery, soft, relaxing speaking voice I've ever heard in my goddamn life. It's just wonderful. So you know what? Especially in the new year, if you're looking for a new read, if you're looking for like a new thing to really sink your teeth into, God only knows there's plenty to rip through, you know, with this book that she's, you know, expertly written and pulled together that, you know, tells the incredible tale of her life. And so I really encourage you to read it. I've only just started, but I'm really enjoying it. Everyone, thank you for listening. As always, will we be back next week? Of course we will. We'll be back next week with a fabulous new guest. And until then, take care of yourselves. Enjoy some pop culture. Go listen to some music. Just take care of yourselves. All right, we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.